What do you think it means to be a person?
I don't know.
Me either. Really.
Go.
Say scratch that again.
Scratch that a fan.
I'm Caitlin Metz, a non-binary illustrator and designer.
I'm Rebecca Tossig, a disabled storyteller and writer.
And this is Scratch That, Parenting and Reparenting Off Script.
A podcast for people trying to parent and person at the same time.
Head over to our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast, for show notes and a transcript of today's episode. And also to join the conversation.
Thank you for being here.
Hi, friends.
Happy Monday.
Here we are. Oh, my gosh. I'm honestly, like, since these two folks hopped on this call with us, my heart has not stopped pounding. I'm so excited that we have Lucy and James Catchpole with us today. I'm like, my face is already hurting from all the smiling I'm doing just being in the presence of these two. If you don't already know who they are, hop on to the episode that aired before this one, because I did my whole little gush fest about Lucy and James Catchpole and the things that they make on that episode. So that will give you a little preview if you don't already know who they are. But when we first launched this podcast and we did a call for, like, who do you want us to interview on Scratch That, there were so many people that tagged Lucy and James. So I feel like most of you maybe already do know about them. I think part of that is that you have a very devoted fan base. The people love you. But also, I think there's something about the two of you that are very well suited for the kinds of conversations we have on this podcast. You're kind of perfect for digging into the themes that we're interested in, which is a lot about rewriting scripts. And you two do that in a really specific, interesting, thought-provoking way with the scripts that we have often given children, disabled children, about disability, the default scripts that a lot of times many of us don't question. They feel like the default way of understanding disability or relating to disabled kids. And you two are really pushing against that directly in really exciting ways. I also feel like the two of you have just been building this, what, from watching across the ocean, feels like this life that is brimming with a lot of creativity with these two girls that you have in your family. You've devoted a lot of your energy to creating these books and this whole, like, agency that you have. We want to dig into all of that. But I also want to just throw something in the air of something I've noticed about the two of you. And I don't know how this will land for you or how it will feel. But one of the just, like, deeply personal reasons why I've been excited to talk to you is that you have, you both exude this energy that is difficult to describe, but I will do my best. I feel like the two of you have this way of being in the world where you are not bending to the current, the, like, rushing current around you, but you seem very rooted and settled. Like, you have this North Star in you. You know who you are. You know what you want to bring to the world. You seem so steady in that, both in the, like, the creative things that you make, but just, like, the way that you show up on the internet, which is just, like, a wild place to be, especially these days. But you seem so steady in yourselves. And I find that to be so compelling and attractive to me, like the kind of energy I want to be near. So all that to say, we have so much to talk about with the two of you. Lots of questions. The first of which we ask all of our guests, which is just to tell us a little bit about little Lucy and little James. So if you wouldn't mind bringing us into a little bit about who the two of you were as little selves, the stories that you were hearing about who you are to the world and where you fit in the world, and who that little person was. So that was a lot of words. We're so excited to have you. Thank you.
That's very nice. We're British, so that I've never heard the word gush fest before, but I instinctively know that it's not something that I cope with very well. It makes British people sort of shrivel a little bit. But it was very nice. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome for that awkward, cringe feeling. Yes.
I wonder now just if we're very old.
Maybe when you see settled, like we just, I mean, that we're very, very settled. We've been in this house for 20 years, if that's what you mean. And before that, we were in a flat which was two roads away. Yeah. So we've not gone far. Before that, I was in university, eight roads away. So
nice.
Geographically, we're very settled.
Yeah. It works. It feels like it's a vibe that's working for the two of you. I just want to be around it. However it's developed and cultivated.
Yeah, I think it's developed because it's had to. You know, it's developed by necessity. Yeah. You know, life's horizons narrowed for both of us at some point. And then we had to get used to that. And both at sort of different rates and at different times, didn't we?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think we've just had a lot of time to get used to it now, haven't we?
Yeah.
And then life's horizons opened up wonderfully with the girls and the agency and the books. And
yeah.
So now actually... just feels like we're rather lovely. Like,
yeah.
I'm afraid to say that because I'm taking them for granted.
My disability has given us a lot of difficulty, a lot of our life is really very, very restricted. Mm. And I think there's an advantage to when your starting point is actually what can we still do?
Mm.
What can we still have and live? And I wonder if that's, I was listening to your one of your podcast episodes the other day and thinking about the sort of pressure of being a mother, and we've gone off topic terribly. Sorry.
Perhaps you won't know.
This is great. This is all that we want. Yes.
I was thinking about all the pressure of being a mother and how for a lot of disabled women is that there's an extra pressure of a sort of societal perfection that we can't ever reach. And the honest truth is that I don't feel very affected by that. I feel very, very lucky. But I think that's because I sort of grieved any, my life is so far from normality because I lie down 95% of the time.
It might be more than that. It is much more than that.
And so I'm doing everything from bed, and I've gone out of the house once since the 1st of January, we've gone out once. And so you are left with what can we do? What joy can there be? And the answer is an enormous amount as it turns out.
Yeah.
But that means that a lot of I can't hope to attain to any sort of normal ideas of motherhood and what that might look like. So that's actually a very liberating starting point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what that reminds me of, Lucy, as you're describing that? It reminds me, I've made this connection in other contexts before, but it reminds me of there is this narrative in the world that limitation is always bad. Like, it must be better that we have endless options and like all the space to do whatever and infinite choices. But when we think about like creativity and different creative expressions, like a haiku, for example, like the limitation is the thing that creates the parameters for that very particular expression. And that's what I feel like I'm hearing in the way you describe that is like these are the very particular parameters of our poem, and that's maybe part of exactly what I'm noticing before having the language for it of like this is the haiku or this is the sonnet that
this
you
is
guys
the picture book text of 300 words in 12 to 14 spreads.
I can do.
Wow. I love that picture.
It's
so
the restraint
that breeds the creativity because when you are so restrained creatively, physically, whatever that restraint is, like you have to just like bounce against the walls and find something new. This is so beautiful. I talk to my students about this all the time in terms of like the creative constraints that I'm giving them for their projects, but I wasn't considering it in this context.
Yeah.
Yes, of lives as well. It's true. Yeah. So I met up with a friend I hadn't seen in 38 years yesterday, Wednesday, day before yesterday. I did a school visit in London with one of our picture books, and it just so happened that one of the children in the class turned out to be his daughter, this boy I was best friends with at school when I was 6, 7, and 8. The teacher had already asked the class if anyone knew anyone with a disability, because we've got this author coming in to talk about disability and read his book. And she put her hand up and said, my dad was best friends with a man with one leg. And then it turned out to be me, which is all too good of a coincidence. London's not a small place either. So it was a lovely coincidence. I met up with him the other day and had that strange thing of trying to recount one's entire life. You know, what happened to you after you were eight? Go through a period of time and pass the baton back and forth. And it is funny accounting for your life in that way, because there was, I mean, because of disability in both our cases, but, you know, rather differently for you and for me, a point where life's horizons narrowed enormously. And that's not to say it wasn't really, really difficult for both of us. It happened at different times as well, which is tricky. You had your horizons narrowed much earlier than me, when you were at university, and mine later. But my experience is that once if you could find your way through the sometimes real agony of that, then out the other side can be a wonderful place. And accept the restrictions, and then suddenly this world has opened out, and what I was able to describe to him now, these books, this agency, these girls, it's just you know, it's a podcast, so you can't see me smiling, but
I feel it. But I think the word the acceptance word that you used makes a lot of sense. It's like the acceptance that we're in a haiku, or the acceptance that we're in a picture book. Like, the part of the pain of that might be that, like, if you want to be like a Victorian novel and you're in the world of a picture book, then maybe some of that pain is the acceptance of what those parameters are.
No one ever said we were in a picture book. When you're 18, your horizons are as wide as you can imagine. You can imagine you might just wander off and live in any country in the world, you know, get together with absolutely any person. Life could be anything at all. But actually, there, even within us, there are the seeds of those restrictions. And you grow up and you discover what they are.
Yeah. And it's very interesting in terms of disability, isn't it? Because I was not disabled until I was 19. And so I was not brought up. There were so many interesting and infuriating things about, I think, for children growing up disabled, and so many horizons are being capped already. And it's an entirely different thing to have believed that everything was out there and then to have it very quickly cut down like that.
Which is not, okay, so maybe we, if you don't mind backtracking, because I think this is a really interesting thing that I would love for us to dig into a little bit, is both like the beginnings for both of you and childhood, and maybe some of the things that feel significant about that. And then also the ways that that might be different for the two of you. Because what you just named, Lucy, about like the difference between coming to that at 19 versus, I don't know how old you were, James, but younger, I think, and how that is different. That's a different way of coming into the world and what you imagine for yourself. So I guess I'm asking like a two-part question there. But if we wouldn't mind kind of talking about the early versions, the early stories of you, and then maybe the ways that those have been different.
Sure. Yeah.
I think you have to go first because you're the one with them all.
Lucy made a sign of roundness with her hands. I don't know if it's... It could be
the sound of roundness.
You're the one with breasts. I don't know what that means. Great big ass.
Coherence.
Is that the sign for coherence?
Apparently so. Okay. No. Each other off.
We got there.
No, I'm been disabled right from the get-go. As far as my memories go, so I've pretty much always had one leg. So if I talk about the agonies of horizons narrowing, that's actually all to do with Lucy's disability. Nothing to do with mine whatsoever. My horizons were wide, and they could have been narrow even on my own terms. Actually, interestingly enough, because I've just written about this in this book, Rebecca, that you may know of, because you've written it as well. And what I've been writing about is the fact that up until the age of 14, it was my default to use an artificial leg, which, as a through hip amputee, so someone who's missing one leg on one side all the way up to the hip, an artificial leg is in my experience, a tool. It's something you use to free up your hands, but it's not something you use to run around a playground. I don't even use it to walk to the shop. I don't go out the house with it, really. And nevertheless, I wore it all the way up until 12 to 14 is where I started to really fall out of love with it. And I realized that the tools I used at home, crutches without a leg, was something I could use at school as well, which was a kind of life-changing moment. And that's that my horizons enormously widened at that point, where I stopped dragging this anchor around with me and started running around on sticks. And then all the world opened up. I ended up sort of playing football around the country and then went off around the world with a backpack and all that sort of stuff that you hope to do as a teenager. I did years later play football with, or try to sort of teach football to, a guy who has exactly the same amputation as me, but who had stayed on the leg all the way through. He had obeyed, conformed to, been comfortable with, I don't know, the advice of the prosthetists, and he'd stayed on the artificial leg. And it was sort of too late for him at the age of 20 to pick up a pair of crutches and start playing football. He just couldn't really adapt to it. And
is it worth just mentioning, it's you wouldn't be able to picture it, but the difference between James's leg, because his leg has been entirely gone. He has absolutely no leg. So there was no residual to hook it to anything to. Yeah. I'm sorry, I'll stop talking about that. And so we're talking about a bucket and a stick, essentially a very big, heavy, cumbersome bucket with a strap on and an enormous piece of metal coming down with a foot at the end. It's so to have that under your clothes, which is what James is talking about when he was a child.
It's a very basic bit of technology. I think it still is. Maybe they've made super fancy ones these days and I'm out of date, but it's a really basic, huge, cumbersome piece of technology, which has its purpose and which I use every single day now around the house, but never outside. And so, of course, the transition from looking more normal but walking extremely slowly, you know, plodding around the playground, to suddenly being able to run but looking completely different was an interesting, you can imagine. I mean, it was a little bit of mental gymnastics to do it, but it was odd that that the overall feeling was just one of sort of freedom and joy rather than significantly anything else. That's probably the best way. There's some things up for me. What was your childhood like? It was all right, wasn't it?
My childhood, yeah, it was fine. I'm the only one who remembers it now, which is really unnerving. I'm not sure it really happened in a way, because my mother's dead and I'm not in contact with my father. It's very strange thinking about my childhood. When I talk about it to my daughters, it sounds like I'm in a Victorian novel, because I grew up in the middle of a valley until I was 8, and there were just fields everywhere. So I just thought the whole country was fields and forests, like in the fairy tales that I read. I knew there were cities, but I thought that was the exception. It was quite a shock to realize that's really, really not the case. Like England, not that many valleys and fields, and you know, on the whole, anyway.
But you actually had a you know, circumstantially a grounding in disability, didn't you? You had this lovely role model who plays a part in our life even now.
Yes, my grandfather had been a pilot in the Second World War, and it had left him with. I was very lucky to survive. Everyone else died, as far as I could work out, because he was in the thick of it. So it left him with various disabilities and rheumatoid arthritis, and he used a wheelchair and an electric wheelchair outside the house when I was a child. And he was a really wonderful, wonderful man, extremely warm. And this all went together in my mind, this wonderful electric wheelchair. And this was the 80s, so electric wheelchairs were pretty new at the time. And I'd go out down to the village with him, and everyone would say, "Afternoon, Wing Commander," which I realized the Victorian novel thing, but that is what would happen, and sort of be very lovely and respectful to him. And I saw that and his electric wheelchair as tied up together. So all my associations with wheelchairs are
like a throne, like a rolling throne.
Exactly.
Like an emperor going past, and people could doff their caps and say, "Good afternoon, Wing Commander."
Yeah. And all of the shopkeepers this was like a little village, and the shopkeepers would know that he was coming and would like quickly move whatever out of the way, and they knew how to get the change out because his hands were bad. And so it was a really lovely, all my associations with disability were around him. And actually looking back, now I understand he was a disabled ex-soldiers are the most privileged of disabled people, particularly white, you know, disabled ex-soldiers. And he had money. And so, you know, now I understand that it was in this very specific context. But it's an interesting way to... It's an interesting grounding in disability.
Yeah.
And I was quite shocked when I became disabled myself at 19 at the reality. And, you know, now I look back and realize that he was very good at finding the best in life, at finding, you know, and it would have been extremely difficult for him as well. And things that I remember as games will have been finding ways around access difficulties and all that. But with all of those caveats, it's interesting that as a non-disabled child, my associations with disability were so lovely, really.
I'm still stuck on the metaphor of you talking about walking around with the prosthetic leg on and looking normal.
Yeah.
But being so restricted.
Yes.
And then taking it off, looking very not normal, but like being able to like hurtle all about the place.
That's right.
And that just feels like such a metaphor for being a person and moving through the world in so many different ways. That like image is not going to leave my head, because there's so many times that I'm just like trying to fit in, and it's like, oh my God, I'm just lugging this leg with me. And when you can just set it down and just like use the things that actually work for you. And that feels like, I wonder if this could be a beautiful pivot into how these, we talked about these constraints and what can come from them. How do the constraints on each of you individually, how has that impacted your parenting? And what has that like, have those restraints given you as parents?
Yeah, that's a really good question, isn't it? That's more, I mean, you should take the lead on that, Lucy.
That is really, it's really interesting, isn't it? And I think for me, I mean, let's face it, father's expectations are so low that James could do almost anything and everyone would just, and he's got one leg as well. So you can imagine already a man parents his own child and, you know, angels sing. So a one leg parents
angels
his own
cry.
Child.
They angels do, cry. Yeah. And they come over and they tell me they're crying.
They literally, people literally see him and cry sometimes. So that's what
less so now. I don't have a baby on my, when I had a baby in a sling, that was, I could have monetized that. That was fabulous. A man wrote me this is not to the baby in the sling, is it? This is me just keep you up in a park. But a man wrote me a letter saying he'd had a spiritual awakening just from watching me practicing football. You add the baby onto that as well. And it's, I mean,
oh, yeah. God.
So I
those
feel
days,
like
those days,
it's so, for you, but that's, it's so interesting for us as parents, because the differences are so stark. We knew that James would have to be the primary parent. That's the only way that we were going to be able to do it. And he very much wanted to do that. And so, you know, miraculously in a way, we were able to have the babies. And I just lost the thread. What was the
restrictions on parenting and how it handles that.
Exactly.
So you knew I was going to have to do the majority of the practical stuff.
You had
to figure out what you were going to be able to do.
I did. And I had to get my head around, before we were parents, how very, very different it would all look. And I was saying to James earlier today, when we were together, we were still in our early 20s. I don't think we were married yet. We watched a documentary together, a BBC documentary about disabled parents.
Yeah.
And it made an enormous impression on me. I think I can only think of, there may have been two programs in the last 20 years that I've come across that have been about that. And one of the women on it was struggling. She was a single mother. with dwarfism, and her toddler had outgrown her. And I remember her adapted kitchen, the toddler could now reach the kettle. Mm-hmm. And this was not going very well. And they did a wonderful thing. They got a much more experienced disabled mum on to talk to her. And I was saying to you, I really think this one short interview, so much of my ideas about parenting and my feelings about it came from this one comment. The young woman with dwarfism was struggling and saying that her child wouldn't understand her the limitations on what she could do. And the older woman said, no, that's not true. Your child will adjust to your disability because you are as you are. And that is all he will know. She said, unless you bring guilt to the situation.
Unless you apologize.
Unless you apologize and he can see that you're apologizing for not being
something that he doesn't say.
Yeah, exactly. And the young woman realized that was it. That was what was happening. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what it is that this woman said that made so much sense to me, but just that you had to parent with the absolute absence of guilt. Mm-hmm. Because for this child, you are all they know. You just, of course I can't walk over there. I can't walk. Mm-hmm. You just state it and it is so, and they can see it is so, and so they accept it. And so I realized that I needed to not bring any baggage to that. It just is. Of course I can't do that, darling. You know I can't walk.
Yeah. Not sorry, I can't.
Not sorry.
Sorry, mummy, can't do that.
Just not, I wish I could. You know that if I could. And so then there is no weird, difficult, emotional struggle going on for the child. The child just sees, oh, yeah, you're right. I'll ask daddy to do that, or I won't do that. I'll do a different thing.
I'll do it myself.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, we all have all these sort of archetypes of motherhood in our heads. And my mother was responding to her own mother. My mother was trying to do a very sort of 1970s attachment parent-y, I'll breastfeed forever and have my children on my hip all the time, which wasn't quite mainstream back then, but it was what she did. Mm-hmm. And she was Catholic, and she was trying to be an endlessly giving, a kind of Virgin Mary, the idea of the endlessly selfless, endlessly giving mother. And it was really hard on her and very confusing for us, because no one can be that. No one can be that, because she's human and she had four children.
And when she became disabled later on in life, it did not serve her.
No, it didn't, because then if you've sent the message to your children that they have the expectation that you should be able to provide for all their needs, no matter that you have no limitations, then that is what your children demand of you. So when she became disabled herself, it was agonizing watching it, and my siblings didn't cope terribly well, and they didn't adjust very well, and everyone just expected more and more and more of her. And so I really, really wanted, before I had children, to have thought all of that through. Mm-hmm. And I just realized that that's not the way. You know, my mother had a right to be the very, very bright, interesting woman that she was, aside from motherhood. And maybe if she'd felt able to do that and put boundaries down with us, then we would have understood, because our children have to learn that their parents are people.
Yeah.
And that's an important lesson, isn't it? Because, you know, when they're babies, they don't even know that we're separate beings to them. We're teaching them about human constraints. We're teaching them, I don't see through your eyes, you don't see through my eyes. We're all seeing things differently. Mommy can't do things endlessly. Everyone has their limitations. And I think doing that without bringing guilt and loaded emotion into it has been the key for me.
Lucy, I don't know if you realize that you are speaking to like so many conversations we have on this podcast all the time. You're just like singing all the notes of it with such precision. And the question that comes up for me listening to you is maybe twofold. Okay, first of all, I would just say, like, I'm so grateful for that BBC documentary that you watched, because as soon as you said that you watched a documentary about disabled parenting, I was like, oh no, it's going to be bad, because that's what I'm used to. And so, like, the fact that it gave you, I mean, obviously, think about the power of that storytelling, that you took that with you. So I guess my question here, just to, like, dig into that a little bit more, because I'm really into this. You were given this, like, new script, almost, like, you learned this new way of thinking about it before you were even a parent. And then these two wonderful beings came into your life and you were embodying that. And I'm curious if you ever thought that within yourself, or if there were ever moments where you were like, you felt it cropping up and you were like, no, I that is not the way that I want to go. I'm going to pivot. And or if mom guilt, I'm not even exactly sure what mom guilt is, but I know it's a term and I feel like I probably feel it in some way. Does that ever come to you in different forms, like outside of disability or in some other way? So I guess all I'm thinking about is, like, are there ways that ever gets complicated for you? Or do you feel like the sturdiness of it has carried you and that has not come back to you, that you haven't had to struggle with it because it's so clear to you, once you learned it, you learned it kind of thing. Does that make sense, what I'm asking?
Yeah, it does make sense. And I kind of wish I could give you an example of tussling with this, but I think the truth is, of course, I'd wanted to be a different sort of parent. I'd wanted to have a different sort of life. And of course, there's grief around that. There's loss. And so that's there somewhere, but two things can be true at the same time. And in the moment, I don't find myself plagued by that, because it's sort of endless, isn't it? Once I wish I could go up the stairs and help you brush your teeth, and I wish that I could, I don't know, get in a car and drive my children to, but that's just so busy. That's like you saying, you know, you wish you could grow wings and fly. Wouldn't it be lovely, Rebecca, if you could grow wings and fly? That would be very lovely. And you could fly your son around. But it would be ridiculous to be sad about that, because that's not a world that was ever going to exist. And that's really how I feel. And that's how, particularly our eldest daughter, who's 10 now, how I sort of explained it to her. Because the truth is, both my children have gone through some sadness with realizing mummy will never walk. And I'm absolutely categorical about that. And that has been, you know, there's a lump in your throat every time you have to say, that's right, darling, I can't walk. No, and I won't ever be able to walk. You know, you have a bit of a lump, but I feel it's really important for me not to put my own emotions about that onto these children, because they deserve just the fact, and that is the fact. And the fact is that sometimes it might make me a bit sad, but I can tell them that without putting that feeling onto them. Do you know what I mean? What's been very useful is saying to my daughter, yeah, of course I wish my life had turned out differently in some ways. Of course I wish I could walk. But then I wouldn't have met Daddy. I wouldn't have had you. And that makes it very, very easy. And she's really run with that. And now I had a conversation between us, our six-year-old and our 10-year-old, where Violet's been a bit sad recently that mummy can't walk, hasn't she?
Yeah, she's mentioned it.
And it's interesting as well, because she's been saying, I love that you're an author. And I suppose, would you be an author if you weren't if you weren't disabled, would you be an author? And I love that you're an author, but I also really wish you could walk. And, you know, all I can do is agree with that. Yeah, it would be really nice if I could walk. Oh, well, you know. And I heard me saying to her, well, Vava, but if mummy could walk, she probably wouldn't have even had us.
Mm. Oh, wow.
And so that's, you know.
Mm. Oh, thank you for bringing us into that. I'm soaking this up like a thirsty sponge. I think that, again, it's just reminding me of the power of having examples and stories like you had with that BBC documentary of, like, this is, I mean, like, you're literally narrating a script of how to talk to your kid about that. And I'm like, I think a lot of us are so hungry for that. So thank you for offering that with such steadiness and honesty and the both end of it, you know? I think part of my questioning for you with that is, that I had, I think there were certain amount of idealism that I had before Otto was born about what kind of disabled mother I would be and what that would feel like. And I think it has been messier than I expected. But I think one of the things I appreciate about the way that you've described it is really clarifying like what it is that we're offering our kids through any of that. Like when you were narrating that, like, oh, I could say, I wish I could, but I can't. You're like the emotion of that, and then thinking about what is that actually offering your child. But there's this sturdiness and honesty in the way you've described it that really resonates with me. So thank you for that.
The thing I don't know that this is a follow-up question, but the thing that keeps just returning to me as I'm listening to you guys talk is how grounded in reality this is. That like it's like, sure, you could wish something is one way, but you're so deeply grounded in what is, you're not wasting time or energy trying to contort yourself into something that is impossible. And so that you can just like put all of that energy into what is. It makes me think of the conversation, Rebecca, that we had with Maria Bowler.
About reality. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. About reality and just like what, paying attention to what is instead of what it could be, which comes back to this question. Interrupting this episode to say thank you to everyone supporting the podcast on Patreon.
We love seeing your comments come through. We love getting to know each of you better. Like, you being there really means the world to us.
If you want to support the project financially, you can become a paying patron for as low as $5 a month. That's less than a latte.
But there's lots of free ways to support the podcast too. Sharing episodes, giving us one of those very pretty 5-star reviews, all of that makes a huge difference too.
And you can also join Patreon without paying. So the show notes will always be there for you. Okay, back to the show.
When I was doing my gush fest, I'm so sorry, my gush fest.
It sounds like a really badly organized music festival, maybe.
Everyone is a little bit uncomfortable. When I was talking about part of what I really loved about the Mama Carr, What Happened to You and You're So Amazing books, was a little bit about what I feel like. Maybe this is a leap. It's not a leap in my brain. I don't know how this will feel to other people, but when we're talking about the sturdiness of reality and both and being in and like what is real and true, I feel like one of the things I love about these three picture books that we have now that you've given us, the picture of disability that it gives us, I feel like, is so ordinary and simple, in like there's like, it's not even like we're having that there's, I mean, I think there are lessons to learn in them, right? But the forefront of the story is just this very simple little glimpse into this real experience of a real kid. Joe feels very real to me, of a real kid's experience on a playground, or the very real ordinary intimacy that a child would have with a mother's wheelchair. So I think that it makes sense that how we're experiencing you in this conversation would reflect the way that I experience these picture books that you have given us. And so I guess maybe as we pivot into talking about the things that you all create, these beautiful things, works of art and stories that you've given us, maybe we could just start by talking a little bit about scripts and naming for folks who are listening, like, specifically the scripts that you sought to undo with the making of those books. And then what is this new script that you are hoping that kids and parents will absorb as they read them?
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, I didn't mean to write the first book. It wasn't ever an intention of mine as a literary agent to write a book about disability, but the opportunity came along because an illustrator sent me a character she'd drawn, a teddy bear who had lost a leg. It wasn't intended to be a story about disability. It was just a story about a toy that had come apart. But nevertheless, it still needed to feel real. And I told her that the story didn't quite, but I could maybe have a go at writing it. And she said, yeah, that'd be great. And so the opportunity suddenly was there to try and fill this very obvious gap in the market for a picture book about disability that wasn't dreadful.
So true.
My word, carefully. And when we started to think about what that one story is, you know, I could only assume this would be one story, one other thing. What would that story be? What would be the one story I'd want to tell about having been a disabled child? And it just had to be the strange ways that people relate to you. And specifically as a child, the daily, I was going to say monstering in the paper. Monster, perhaps too harsh a word, but the gauntlet of questions, which I say monstering because it's not intended. It's so often it's not in any way badly intended. Sometimes it is, but almost always it's not, especially with little ones. The question is asked, but because the question is asked by one child at small child volume, which is audible, every other child, even if they already know the answer, their ears prick up. And one child asking the question immediately becomes a mob. All the children are suddenly interested, and you're one child having to account for yourself to everyone. That had to be the experience to talk about, the experience of having that crucial question asked again and again every playtime by some, you know, by another child at school who hadn't asked it before, or who had just liked asking. So that was the experience. And then the script to flip, or we used narrative, really. We used the word narrative more than script, but I think we mean the same thing by it, don't we? The script to flip was this strange sort of presumption that I picked up on and that Lucy had made me kind of consciously aware of since my, you know, teens and 20s, that an awful lot of people, everyone wanted to know. Everyone in public wanted to know what would happen, what happened to my leg. But it was sort of bolstered and justified by this assumption that asking that question of a stranger was somehow actually the right thing to do. People would very polite people, a man once in a cathedral where I was just sitting eating a sandwich, I think, shuffled up to me and said, I do always think it's best to ask. Dot, dot, dot. You know, ever since then, I started thinking, best for who? For whom is it best that you
why?
Ask?
Why? Why? So James is sitting there thinking, here I am being all one-legged.
Yes.
Oh, if only someone would interrogate that.
If only someone would. Oh. And then we could all feel so much more comfortable about it. It was a strange assumption. And it was only while writing that book that we realized, latterly, actually, it was already in the can, that we realized that the biggest book out there in America on the subject of, the biggest picture book on the subject of disability was called Just Ask. It had the diametric opposite message to the one that I was hoping to get out there. So suddenly, you know, I think we had suspected there was a script to be flipped, and then suddenly it became apparent that there really was. Mm-hmm. And a script, you know, that had the backing of and someone as important as a Supreme Court justice. We anticipated pushback, actually.
We really thought there would be a lot of pushback, because in daily life, what you get, and we're in a very nice, we're in Oxford, everyone's very polite. It's not a hard place to be disabled in lots and lots of ways, socially. But nonetheless, you know, there's a question that you got and got and got and got.
Mm.
And so I was really worried about what was going to happen when James brought the book out and what the public response. I thought people would be really angry. People don't have very many feelings about disabled people, but the things that they do, they hold quite tightly to. And so for James to be kind of battering that down and taking their stuff away, taking away their right to...
They're right to know.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Or just to ask, to know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And was there pushback?
Only quietly. Sort of subterranean pushback.
Nice.
that in certain quarters.
Parents of disabled children, yes. A little bit.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
By no means all, but there is a culture, isn't
yeah.
there?
Oh, yeah.
With parents of disabled children, whereby the maybe it's the medical establishment that has encouraged this, but the word has gone out that the best thing to do for your child is to constantly explain yep. them to everyone and for them to explain themselves to everyone in the name of awareness, which just is a way of saying to the world, my child, unlike all these other children, has no boundaries and no privacy. They're a sort of walking teachable moment or a wheeling teachable moment. So, yes, there was a little pushback, but not brave enough that it made itself explicit to us. It just sort of rumbled on in the
all
background.
Right, right. Nice. Sorry. Go ahead, Lucy.
Just like time. I think we must have been very lucky.
5 years earlier.
5 years earlier, I think there would have been a lot more. We must have.
I experienced a version of that with my book. I have a chapter that's all about kindness, like the complications of kindness. And that is the chapter that people get real fussy about. They're like, but I think it's important that I should be able to whatever the thing is. It's sort of like, but that's my tool. That's my story. You're taking away the way that I feel like is right and good for me to interact with disability.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. The kind thing. I know the chapter that you mean in your work, and I've so underlined and barely read it. Do you remember when my eldest daughter came back from preschool, I think it was, saying, Mrs. Smith says we have to be really kind to people in wheelchairs. And it was the first time that she had received any information I knew about disability outside our house. And she just stopped and she looked at me and I thought, so that doesn't feel quite right to her. And I said, really, darling? So mummy uses a wheelchair, doesn't she? So do you think everyone should be really kind to me? She sort of looked really perplexed and said, not really.
Not necessarily. Oh my gosh. Wow.
It didn't feel right.
There's something weird about this. Yeah.
Yes. You brought the slogan home, perhaps without interrogating it, and then it just sort of met reality and fell apart.
I want to hear more about the picture books, but something you said, James, really caught my ear, and I'm just curious. This might be a weird question, but it's something I've been grappling with personally myself as like a writer and creator. You said something when you were talking about the origin story of writing, what happened to you? That's what it's called, right? Why I blanked for just a second. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And you said, I didn't set out to write a book about disability. It's like how you described it. And as you were talking about, this is going to be a windy question, so please bear with me. But I have been really thinking a lot these days about as a creator, so much of the things that I've been creating have been kind of like disability forward. So much of what I write is specifically about disability. And I had this kind of odd moment recently where I was thinking about what you said also, James, about like so many parents of kids with disabilities kind of learn somewhere that it's good and right for disabled kids to explain and teach about their disability. So that was my experience. And I remember like my starting a new school and my mom kind of being next to me and us having like a little lesson on me. And then there was a Q&A about me. And the message of that was like, she just wants to be treated like everybody else. But the irony is like, no one else has a Q&A about their bodies.
No, right?
Right. So I'm just a little...
The actions speak louder than the words, sadly.
I think what I love about the books that you've given us is that it is not that teaching. It's not that kid kind of answering the questions about disability. But I'm also curious about what you said about like, I didn't set out to write this book. Is there any part of you that feels like, are you interested in or would you ever want to be writing picture books that are about other things? Do you feel free to do that as writers? Are you curious or interested in doing that? Is that even on your radar as you're thinking about what you create in the world?
I've probably elided two things there, Rebecca, because I never intended to be an author at all. I'm just an agent. I edit other people's stories and I write little, I don't troll anyone. I write little bits of their stories sometimes, but I write the odd line in their voices if I can, as a way of suggesting things. I do have an idea for a story that's not about disability, but I've never actually been tempted to start writing it down. Maybe I don't love it enough. Maybe after having written What Happened to You, which felt like, it's a story that entertained me and it came from something I knew extremely well and it had a genuine sort of real purpose in the world.
Yeah.
Maybe writing about something else, I can't quite imagine, but I really want to.
Yes.
It would have to be so good, It would have to be kind of Ruffalo standard for me to actually write about a bear or a tortoise or a...
Yeah.
So I don't think I'm your kind of archetypal creator. I think I've ended up creating because, as an agent, the chance came to me to do something that I knew not many other people could do.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. But Lucy, I mean, Lucy is someone who actually, you would be writing a book, wouldn't you? At some point, you'd started a novel, you did a creative writing course. I think this was more your destiny to be a writer than it was mine.
Yeah. And my stammer is just so extremely limited.
Mm-hmm.
That it's lovely for me that I've managed to write, a book because I don't know. But I do find it very interesting. It is a very interesting question because that becomes your niche. Disability is your identity and sort of becomes your niche. And I am sometimes troubled by that. I think I really like the fact that we don't have a massive Instagram following. And the people that we do have don't expect me to always write about disability on Instagram. And I really appreciate that. And I also think that there's a purpose there when people know that I am as disabled as I am. But I can write about, Shakespeare film night with the children. And so it's all, I've got a lovely friend who is not disabled, but is a creator on social media. And she's always saying that all of the other stuff, the things about my life it's all sort of disabled joy. And it's all in the context of my disability. And therefore,
if you are writing about Shakespeare Night with the Girls, it's not about disability, but the knowledge that you can't go out to cinema and that this is a thing that you can do with the girls in bed is still there in the background, isn't it?
Yeah. I suppose what I'm saying really is that when we're expected to write very narrowly about our experience around disability, that's very confining and it can also just push the public imagination further and further down this one route.
Yeah.
Because that is all we are allowed to write about. And so it is all we write about. And I love social media for the fact that it gives me complete control. And so I can write about all the other bits of my life. And I think that's doing something because it's showing we are much more.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Thank you for all of this processing with me. I have just been very in my head and like questioning and trying to figure out what feels right, because every single thing that both of you have said makes so much sense to me, and all of it feels true at once. And I think that what I am moving into is just what you've said, Lucy, of like trying to find ways to continue to tell the stories that I feel like are important and valuable, and also find ways to open up the boundaries and edges of what those stories are. Like just that Shakespeare story that you described is exactly it, right? It's embodied, it's tethered to the truth, but focus can be shifting, or we can kind of expand the edges of what's allowed to be included in that story or what's in the forefront. And also, can I just say, side note, you do this series of slides, I think every few years, about the months of the year and like, right? And I delight in it so hard. I love that you have this knowledge about like, right? Okay. And now I'm embarrassed because I'm like, I want to repeat back to you what I've learned and I'm not sure if I can, but it's like, there were 2 months of the year that didn't exist in the Roman calendar. Yes. And
it's today. Happy New Year. After midnight, the 1st of March.
Oh, my God.
Calendar.
I wouldn't.
Because January and February were just ghastly. Everyone was just trying to survive, right? And, you know,
they were sort of covered in goose fat and sackcloth, just shivering and
just hoping that the firewood lasted until spring and no more of your children died. So you didn't even want to name them, you know?
They weren't on the Peloton, I'll tell you that.
Yes, I just love that. I love that so much. I would not know that if it wasn't for you. I love that you put that on your account. Like, that is part of the narrative, like, that is part of the world that you're creating in that space, and disability is there and other things are there and it all converges. Like, I just think that's unique in the world we live in right now, where everything is like branded and, you know, like, what's my angle and my POV and my audience is here for this very specific thing. And I just think you're both doing that beautifully. So I just had to ask you about it. Okay. Owning it. We got to talk about owning it. Okay. All right. Talk to us about owning it, because this is this. I'm like so super excited about this collection of essays. It's unlike anything else that exists in the world that I'm aware of. Can you speak to like the impetus for the project, the inspiration for it, and what you hope it brings to readers?
Yeah, probably. I hope we can. We get to this point with a book where, you know, you've been working on it for so long that actually you become the worst person in the world at pitching it. I need an agent to pitch it for me, or pitch it for us. What was the impetus, Lucy? It was at the launch of What Happened to You. We got talking to Jen Campbell, the book reviewer and author, and was it her idea, was it ours? I can't remember, but somehow we knew that this didn't exist. An anthology, middle grade anthology, so ages 9 to 13 or so, of memories, of childhood memories from disabled authors, to function as a way of sort of trying to see if we can pass on some sort of wisdom to the next generation, which it sounds like a bit of a cheesy thing to say, but it does sort of have a import with disability, doesn't it? Because
yes,
most disabled children don't grow up with disabled role models in their own family, in their own friendship groups. It's so important at some point in life to kind of find that tribe of people who are like yourself. It's certainly for our generation, it didn't automatically happen.
I think there's quite a lot of suspicion around disabled adults, really, isn't there, if we're honest? Mm. There's certainly an impression, like, I mean, I was not a disabled child, so I have to be careful about that. But I get the impression that there's the idea that disabled adults might have useful things to impart is surprisingly radical and new.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the impetus, certainly with people I knew, was that, you know, the word disabled wasn't really even used, so there wasn't a presumption that there would really be any sort of useful solidarity there. It's almost better not for you to meet your peers in that way. So the thought occurred to us that it might be possible to try and offer that, and because of the wonders of Instagram, we knew a whole bunch of people like you, Rebecca, and, you know, it would have been a tricky thing to do 20 years ago, but because of the internet, we realized we knew people with as wide a variety of disabilities as we could hope for, from the US, Canada, UK, Australia, throughout the Anglosphere, a few more countries besides, all sorts of backgrounds. It's just such an interesting project to work on, and to ask everyone for a memory, to have them trust us with something deeply sort of personal and vulnerable and valuable, to know, because we ourselves as editors are disabled and know what the scripts are, that we won't start nudging them towards some, you know, the script that's going to work commercially, for them to trust us with it, and then to have these stories come in, which are from such different people, such different experiences, and yet the commonalities that have come out of it are just fascinating.
Yeah, there really is. We've got Ali, who was caught in the war, Baghdad.
2003, one of the first, you know, bombs.
Yeah, and so lost limbs. And he talks about charity from that fascinating perspective where he was splashed all over the front pages of newspapers as a child.
He became the image, the anti-war image around the world against the Iraq war. So you can imagine the attention that garnered him. He suddenly had, you know, politicians visiting with gifts. A boy who had always wanted to have a PlayStation and used to queue up outside the internet cafe suddenly had a PlayStation but didn't have any arms left to play with it. He had to learn to play with his feet. So that perspective on charity to someone like Stephen, who runs the squeaky wheel.
Oh, yeah.
Who uses a power chair. And he's written this brilliant essay called The Price of Free about all the stuff he was given and throughout his childhood and the strange dance around whether to accept it, which, of course, comes up in the very first chapter of the book, which is yours, Rebecca, that bloody great teddy bear.
I cannot wait to read these all in one gulp because I like, it's just wild to hear like just that one theme come up in so many different lives and forms. I just like exactly what you're saying. Like the idea that there would be a legacy or like a sense of culture passed on, like these narratives passed on, a collection of voices. That's exactly right. Like, we didn't have anything like that. I didn't belong to anything. There was no history that I was a part of, that I was, you know, aware of. And so I love that idea of that being part of that culture making of that sense that we belong to a bigger collection of voices and seeing ourselves in that.
Yeah, a cultural movement. Yeah, yeah. And it was always there. And it had been, you delight in finding these photographs from 100 years ago, or sort of the blind workers march.
They marched in 1920.
With signs saying, justice, not charity.
Oh. Justice, not charity.
100 years ago. This has always been there, but we don't know we're part of it. Someone tells us.
Especially not when we're kids. As kids, I mean, so much, like you said also, so much of it is like, it's almost like you're not even encouraged to be around each other. Like, it's almost like this, I don't know, I even felt that just myself of like, oh, I don't belong on that bus with those kids. I'm supposed to be, you know, you describing those posters, I have goosebumps that like went up to my cheeks listening to you describe that. We need to know those stories. We need to know this history. I'm so excited for this book. It comes out April 24th. Am I right about that? Is that the right date?
In the UK, April 24th, and in US and Canada and Australia in August, but we don't have a date for you yet.
We can still purchase it from the Blackwells.
You can buy it through Blackwells, wherever you are in the world. And the postage is included, as you know. Blackwells is our local bookshop.
Is it really?
Bizarre. And it's also the one place that you can order from all over the world. Yeah, it's half a mile down the road or something.
That's so sweet.
I am so greedy for the words from both of you. I feel like I could talk to you for ages and ages and ages. We got to find another way to keep talking because I just, like, the two of you, I just want more of your presence in my life. I'm very greedy for it, as I've said. Caitlin, do you want to close us out with a question about the songs? Unless there's anything else, I don't want to prematurely.
No, this has been a delight. I just want to talk about constraints and letting guilt go. And I just want to have a whole other interview where that's all we talk about.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure.
So lovely. So we are building a collaborative playlist where we ask guests and listeners to tell us the song that has held them as parents or as people or both. If you had to choose a song that has held
you. Do you have one?
So we do a lot of singing with the kids, don't we? We do family singing. So, I mean, our first choice isn't something that will help you at all. But when we used to run, I used to run down the road this little playgroup when they were tiny. And then when the pandemic came along, we sort of put it online and did it once a week on Instagram. And we had that burst of pandemic energy, of creative pandemic energy that people had if they were ill. Mm-hmm. And so we took a song every week and adapted it. And I always think of it, it's not a playlist song because you can't go and stick, you know, the What is it? It's
a little oh, my darling Clementine.
Clementine, old American.
Oh, we can find that.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
But you know, version, it was in a, in a lockdown, in a quiet town where the children used to play. Lived a sister, never missed an opportunity. And then she'd pop up, a little three-year-old would pop up and say, getting bored now, this is boring.
Will
the illness ever end?
Will this ever end?
Want my
playroom,
want my friends. So that maybe, but I mean, I can't pretend we play the original, not that there's an original, but you know, some old recording of Clementine from whatever the hell that was written. Was
it? Will you send us the lyrics that you wrote for that? Just so people can, in the show notes, can like hold that song, the tune in their head.
Oh yeah, I love that idea.
We can send you the link if you like. I mean, the video is still up there.
The video's.
Oh, please, please.
We'll definitely put that link. That's what I mean about this family. You feel it, right? This like burst of creativity, the like rootedness, the it's the constraints and the things that you're there growing within that. I don't know. I want to be around it all the time. All right. We need to let you go rest and have the rest of your time in your evening. We're just really grateful for you. Thank you for all of your wisdom and insights and stories. So bye, everyone. All right.
In a lockdown, in a quiet town where the children used to play, lived a sister, never missed an opportunity to say,
getting bored now, this is boring, will the illness ever end? Want the playground, want my home, I want my school, and all my friends.
Oh my children, wish I knew just what to say. But this cannot last forever, things will change again someday.
Getting bored now, this is boring, will the illness ever end? Want the playground, want my home, want my school and all my friends.
Oh my children.
This podcast is edited and perfected by the most beautiful wizard and my favorite dude, Micah Jones.
For all the show notes and a transcript of today's episode, check out our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast. This is our hub. It's where you can join the conversation and be part of our community.
If today's episode resonated with you or made you think of someone, share it.
And if you want to support the pod and also make us glow inside, go give a 5-star review on Apple. That would be so lovely.
Thank you for being here, for listening, for being a part of this community.
We love you so much.